Wait. Because before we get into that, I was not terribly involved. Because like there were times when I willingly be the queen for 2 more weeks. So I have absolutely no idea that we are not terribly concerned about the quality of the show necessarily. And huge high five from this guy.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls of the internet, welcome to Bad Voltage Season 1, Episode 22. My name is John O'Bacon, and we also have on this show Mr. Stuart Ian Langridge. Say hello.
Hello.
We also have Mr. Jeremy Barbara Garcia. Say hello.
Hello.
We do not have Brian Lundu.
Surprise.
Right, yeah, because... And we're not even going to make an excuse that, you know, he was busy or something like that. Something terrible may have happened in his life, but he just did not show up for the recording. So we're hoping that everything's okay with Brian. I'm sure everything is.
He's, I was going to say, before we take the piss out of him too much, we should make sure he's all right.
Right, exactly. So, you know, assuming everything's okay, we'll give him some shit after that. Anyway, Mr. Langridge, what are we going to be talking about on this delicious episode?
We're going to start off talking about open source projects making hardware and why they're all pathetically bobbins at it.
And then Jono is going to review a recently procured Samsung Gear Live.
We're then going to get into a discussion about, we were promised this amazing world of free culture years back, and it hasn't really happened. We don't really see all the Creative Commons free culture bans, videos, and all the rest of it. So we're going to get into why that hasn't happened.
We spoke about Linux Voice, the magazine and free culture project, last week, and... as promised, we've got Graham Morrison on the show to ask him some questions.
And then we're also going to be launching a brand new competition with some interesting prizes. So stay tuned for that. So, El Papa Garcia.
Eora, Bad Voltage.
For the first time, it's now actually legal in the UK to make backup copies of some of your things, to make parodies of copyrighted material. It surprises an awful lot of people to learn that up until very, very recently, this stuff wasn't actually legal. An awful lot of the internet discussion on copyright revolves around the US copyright law, but it's a lot different in other countries. So the UK, as of only a couple of weeks before this show, now has parody and backup exemptions to copyright. What I think is interesting about this, we're slowly starting to see the copyright laws loosen a little bit. But we had Lawrence Lessig telling us about this stuff 10, 15 years ago. When they first set up Creative Commons, they started talking about, or Lessig in particular, but the Creative Commons movement as a whole, talked about how we'd be embodying and creating a remix culture, something where things would be sampled and brought together, where you'd be able to take existing material and then build on it, make transformative use of it. 10 years later, has any of it happened?
It is the burning question, isn't it? Because building on that point, there's lots of different elements that go into, I think, making free culture, right? There is the licensing bit, which Creative Commons people and Lessig banged on about, like, you know, the rights to be able to do this. But then I think more importantly, in many ways, there is just the nuts and bolts of how you build that free culture content. There is recording software and affordable instruments and a place to record for music and video editing software and 3D production tools and all the rest of it. What's interesting to me is that technology has moved on, and that technology has empowered a generation of people to create content. Look at YouTube, right? YouTube is brimming with people who are creating interesting content and really professional looking content as well. But no one cares about the free culture piece.
That's the thing I think is critically important here. My daughter is 14, right? And she gets an awful lot of her entertainment, and things she watches are not TV programs on television anymore. They're things like PewDiePie and Nash Greer videos on YouTube. These people have got insane followings. Millions and millions of people watch all the videos, and they're all standard YouTube license. This is exactly the sort of thing that we would hope would have been created under a Creative Commons license to enable that kind of remix culture. And the free culture movement has had, as far as I can tell, no effect in getting the message that people should be doing this sort of thing out to people doing this sort of thing.
I think that's one of the biggest failures is the messaging, the education, exactly. That's even an option.
We correctly predicted, the free culture movement in general, correctly predicted the idea that there'd be this massive democratization of tools, that you wouldn't be limited to just receiving your 4 approved channels from your 4 approved television providers. And that came completely true. We have YouTube. Anyone can publish stuff. We have YouTube, we have Vimeo, we have Dailymotion, we have SoundCloud for music. We have the software tools that Jono is describing to make this stuff possible. But the free culture movement, the free culture concept, has made no effect at all. We've now got millions and millions and millions of channels, all of which are being used to release content which can't be remixed, can't be edited. So the tools weren't the hard bit. Why hasn't the free culture message taken off?
I think there's two areas there that are interesting. One is there is the quote unquote branding of Creative Commons and free culture, right? And why that hasn't been a success. And I think it's the same reason why ultimately many open source projects have not been successful, is because the main kind of carrot and stick messaging around those things was about licensing and about distribution. And I think most people just don't give a crap about that stuff. It's boring. Any artist who's creating music or video or whatever else, what they're interested in doing is building an audience. They're interested in creating stuff they're proud of and sharing it with an audience. Whereas all the majority of the messaging that came out of the Creative Commons was about licensing.
Yeah, it's like you have to care about this stuff.
Right. I mean, as one personal experience or story here, some years ago, some of our listeners will know, I did a project called Severed Fifth, and the idea was to basically create a completely free culture album and give it away for free, with the idea of demonstrating that you can build a community and you can build a following without being dependent on the recording industry. I went to the Creative Commons in San Francisco when I started Severed Fifth and had a meeting with a guy there who's a friend of mine, and we had a really good meeting. They were really positive about the notion of Severed Fifth, but they were pretty explicit to me that they are not in the business of being a content agency. That they're, you know, because I was wanting them to basically elevate Severed Fifth as an example of Creative Commons in action. And they made it very, very clear that they're not interested in doing that. That's not their business. Their business is they are the creator and the protector of these licenses. So if the number one organization in the world for pushing the free culture movement is not interested in focusing on the content, that's the reason why I think it's not been successful. And I don't blame the Creative Commons here. I think they made the right decision to do that, because you got to work within your wheelhouse. But the other thing is that I think, secondly, that content's on YouTube. And I think from a legal perspective, from our viewpoints as people who know about this kind of stuff, yes, you can't remix it. I think the general public don't give a crap about that. If they're going to remix, they're going to remix it. If you look at the amount of stuff on YouTube, like I watched a video the other day, which was every from Arnold Schwarzenegger mashed together into a video, right? It's like 4.5 minutes long of just Arnold Schwarzenegger. And that probably infringes a bunch of copyright, and it kind of comes into fair use, and maybe it doesn't. But there's tons of videos like that, but no one really cares, right? Because it's not really harming those companies. A small number of companies will make these copyright claims. But I think most, by and large, people don't think I can know the benefit of free culture is because then I can remix other people's content. I think right now it's like people just think, oh, whatever, I'll just remix it anyway.
There is something to be said for the kind of antinomian argument, right? You know, remixing is theft, theft is sin, sin is forgiven, so get stuck in. And you can kind of give people the impression that, you know, this basically is okay, because no one's going to shout at you about it. Most reasonable film companies, television companies, whatever, will recognize that this is not doing their brand any particular harm. It's not doing their commercial properties any particular harm, so you might as well let it go. But I am I am wary of a world in which we can get away with this stuff on sufferance, because what happens is every now and again someone gets made an example of. And it sucks to be that guy.
usually 12-year-olds.
So kind of the unwillingness of the Creative Commons proper to promote Severed Fifth, what was your general experience using Creative Commons to try to promote? Because I know, like, Nine Inch Nails and Trent Reznor specifically took a brand that is very well known and had some success releasing a Creative Commons album, which is much, much different than starting from scratch. And you kind of were in the fortuitous position that you're fairly well known in the free software community. You had someone that was also pretty well known in the music industry. So you weren't even starting from zero. So how would you sum up your experience starting from not being Nine Inch Nails?
I found that within our world, within the open source free culture world, obviously, I mean, there was a lot of support, a lot of interest. The thing that surprised me, so first of all, I think we spread a little bit beyond that community to a degree with Severed Fifth, but not tremendously. Where Severed Fifth became popular outside of that world was really in the Bay Area metal scene. Presumably,
that would have happened were you not Creative Commons, right? You're a new Bay Area metal band.
Exactly. I mean, people came to see us at shows not because we were a free culture band. It was because they liked the music. What was interesting was there were certain individuals in the Bay Area metal scene, like established musicians playing in fairly well-known metal bands, who did not like the fact that we were doing it this way. We had some very, very, I'm not going to say who it is, but there was three or four musicians from reasonably well-known metal bands, which means not well-known at all in the scheme of things.
well-known to metal people, the most incestuous community on earth, worse than the free software community, which is saying something.
Right. Well, they did not like what we were doing.
What was their reasoning?
And it was all about money. Well, it was money. So, and it was partially the free culture thing, but it was partially just whether you make money as well. So I'll give you an example. We would go out and play gigs. We'd play a venue on a Saturday night, and we get to this awkward moment at the end of the night where there's a conversation about money. Are you getting paid or not? Because invariably, you don't necessarily... For me, I didn't care about that. I've got a day job, whatever. I don't care if I get paid. If we can pay for gas money, then brilliant. But don't really care. If you are a full-time musician, particularly playing metal, it's a pretty thrifty life, right? Mm-hmm. You invariably live in Oakland. You live in a pretty small place. You struggle to pay your bills. You don't just get to go to Starbucks and have a latte and not think about the money that you're spending, right? That $200 that you get at the end of a gig, which in many cases can be split across a band, so that $50 that you get at the end of a gig, you need that to eat. Yeah. And I think some of those people saw, hang on a second, the way in which we become successful is that we make music and we get signed and then they give us an advance and then we sell merch. That's my bread and butter. That's going to be replaced with the notion of giving all this shit away for free. Do you remember back in the early days of Linux when people were terrified of it because they thought that it was going to break down their proprietary businesses? It's exactly the same thing.
People are saying, well, if this English bloke with his wide awake suit and his beard manages to sell everyone on the idea that we should just give all this music away, I'm never going to get signed by Roadrunner, so I'm never going to get to play metal full time. This is ridiculous.
Right.
You can see why people think like that.
And it was not...
Corey Doctorow, there are an awful lot of people who have attempted to write books and give them away and got nowhere. I mean, I'm not just talking about someone, serializing their life on LiveJournal. Look at someone like Harry Connolly, who's a sci-fi author, but he's not, a big name. And his blog's terribly depressing. This is a guy who's trying to get a publishing deal or has a publishing deal, but not for everything. And he sold a couple of books, but then he self-published a couple, and he's writing about how well he's done with that and whether it's been successful. This is nothing to do with... This is not specifically Creative Commons. This is just the idea of going your own way. And it's terrible for him. I can't imagine anyone looking at that and going, that's what I want to do with my life. And that becomes more so when you say, and also free culture. But what I think's interesting there, if you look at that, that's those arguments applied 10 years ago. But the free culture community has had very little success. Imagine a world in which the zeitgeist had changed enough that the YouTube license by default was remixes are allowed.
Right.
Right. But they haven't managed to change the zeitgeist to that extent. I'm not talking about going to people and giving them the little chalk talk lecture about copyright law and the Statute of Anne and all that rubbish, right? Just encourage people to buy something like YouTube. It would have been ideal if there was enough free culture stuff in the atmosphere that the YouTube people went, well, we'll make this. I mean, obviously, you can change it if you want to, and they can put a big red notice saying, if you don't want people to remix your content, change it. But by default, if the standard YouTube license, in quotes, was a free culture license, then it would have enabled that massive remix culture that Lessig was talking about. And that hasn't happened.
Well, I think.
Do you think that would have demonstrably changed things, though? Because, I mean, Flickr's license by default was a free license, and at the time, that was by far the biggest.
Flickr's license is not...
For a while, it was definitely Creative Commons by default.
Right, but they changed it because professional photographers threw their toys out.
Yeah, but nobody uses Flickr anymore, so it doesn't matter. When Flickr was popular, do you think that enabled the whole photographic remixing culture?
I think there are an awful lot of people who can now use photos in presentations and things like that. Because they were Creative Commons licensed. Now, there are an awful lot of people who use the photos anyway and don't give a stuff about the licenses. And again, as Jono said earlier, you know, lots of people do that and don't care. Antinomian again.
I think that by definite, and this is a very broad brush, but I think most musicians, definitely musicians, and to a degree, amateur videographers and photographers and whatever else, I think most people just don't give a crap about copyright. So therefore, the benefits of a free culture where you can remix content, people are like, whatever, I'll just use it anyway.
Right.
I think that's one of the reasons why. And I think the other thing as well is that what we really need with this to make free culture successful is there needs to be a poster child for it. There needs to be someone who can break beyond like our world and be incredibly successful and say the reason
why they're in the same way that Dream or Cedar Sings the Blues are not it. What I think's what's more interesting, I think, about your point of view there is that we don't need it. Who cares about free culture? Everyone's going to remix anyway.
Yeah.
Why even push it?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So, I think this is an interesting topic that we can get into on the forum. So what do you folks think about this? I mean, do you think that the free culture revolution is still happening, or has everyone quietly packed up their bags and gone on to something else? Are there examples of free culture that we're missing out on here that we haven't covered in our discussion? Go to community.badvoltage.org and share your thoughts. So today on the show, we've got Graham Morrison, who is from Linux Voice magazine, formerly of the extremely popular Linux Format magazine. How are you doing, Graham?
I'm great. Thanks, Johnny.
Good. Well, thank you for joining us on the show. We were actually due to interview Graham when I was out at OSCON in Portland, and we were going to do an interview over there, but we had some scheduling mishaps due to various extraneous circumstances. Nothing to do with Graham, but we actually covered Linux Voice on the last show, and we talked about it. So first of all, thank you for joining us. But
that's okay.
How's things going with the magazine? I mean, you guys have been on a bit of a roller coaster ride with all of this, right?
Yeah, it has been a roller coaster. I mean, I'm a pretty cautious person, so you know, I'm often asked whether Linux Voice is doing all right, and I think things are going really well. I mean, essentially, we're getting about 180, 200 new subscribers per month, which is just brilliant.
Right.
We didn't really have any idea how the whole thing would go. We kind of did it from our hearts, which I think everyone can see. And while, of course, we have £127,000, $200,000 to start with from the Indiegogo campaign, that's only going to go so far.
Right.
So I think things are going well. I think we're going to survive the first year, which is something that 60 or 70% of new businesses don't do.
What's the hardest thing about doing this? I mean, there's the money that you raised, obviously, but I mean, the thing that really struck me, I'd seen the magazine online, but when I met you in Portland and I saw the printed version, I was just blown away by the quality of it. It really does feel like the kind of magazine that you go into a newsagent's and buy. Like, what's the hardest thing about making that thing? Is it the design? Is it the content? Is it the production? Like,
I think
what's the most difficult?
I think the hardest thing is that it's, well, there's five of us. We have a full-time employee, Stacey Black. She does all the design. But in fact, the hardest part is letting go. We have enough budget for contributors, for example, to pay them. But
right.
But really, this sounds like a sales tactic, but we are really trying to focus on the quality. And so writing less is what we should be doing so that we're not continually working every night and every weekend. But we actually, we don't want to do that because we all like what we're writing about, and we don't know people with quite enough people, because we have some great contributors, but we don't know enough right. people. And so I think we're all slightly overworked. I'm not complaining, but that's the hardest part is actually, so for example, the latest magazine deadline is on Friday. Between now and Friday, I have to read every single page, change lots of things, with lots of things normally needs changing. I still have 4 or 5 pages to write.
Wow.
So that's like 4,000 words to write. I'm really not complaining. I love it. I never thought I'd back in the thick of magazine production like this, but that's the hardest part. And I think if we've only got that problem, then it's all right.
Wow. I might have a word with you about contributor stuff in a bit. But a separate question, you said you're getting a couple of hundred new subscribers every month. Are they primarily print subscribers or primarily online?
We're split almost exactly 50-50. It's not the same. Half of the stats are quite interesting. We should actually publish them because we're not a closed shop in any of this way. Half of our subscribers in the US, but most of our US subscribers subscribe to the digital version because of the price. Really, it's quite an expensive proposition to US people.
Yeah,
something like $90 or $100. But in the UK, we have far more print subscribers. So overall, it's about 50-50, 50% print, 50% digital.
Interesting. I appreciate what Jono is saying about the niceness of the artifact, the actually having a thing that you can hold. But equally, the idea of having a paper magazine which is going to clutter up my drawer forever is insane. So are you trying to lead people towards print subscriptions or towards online, or do you intend to just straddle that divide forever, or do you want to lead that charge or follow it? Or
our back of a beer mat business plan from last November or whenever it was,
champion.
we plan to make about the same money from digital subs as we do from print subs, so there really isn't that much difference. In the Indiegogo campaign, we gave a pretty broad approximation of how much it costs to make an issue. So, digital has its advantages. We are working on EPUB versions and more HTML-friendly versions. At the moment, you can just get a DRM-free PDF. So, at the same time, I like print. This is something that comes up time and time again. I mean, in fact, I was speaking to Tim O'Reilly just a couple of weeks ago at OzCon about the very thing. Every story is about the decline of print, and in particular the decline of magazines, and that's completely true. You know, I worked at Future Publishing for 10 years, and it's in real trouble because of this decline.
He probably doesn't like print, right? Being the head of a publishing company.
Yeah. I know, but yeah, no, I mean, that was the question I asked him, was print dead? But from my perspective, I like vinyl as well, and I like 96 kilohertz, 24-bit audio recordings.
Do you like comfortable trousers as well?
The penny farthing, perhaps. No, but I'm being serious. I agree. There is one of the advantages that you have, I think, at least, and you do please confirm if this is right, is that because you have something of a niche market, you could afford to make plays that someone like Future Publishing necessarily can't. You could afford to take a few more, well, not risks aren't quite the right word, but lavish some extra care onto something.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, that's essentially why we left and why we're trying to do this, is because we think we can make a much better magazine. But I mean, Future Publishing does really do as good a job as it can under the circumstances. It's a huge company, so it has much different problems with scale, many more.
It would be remiss if we didn't ask you probably the burning question that many of our listeners want to know, which is like, why did you guys leave? Like, I mean, it's quite evident. And I think the way in which all of you have handled this situation has been obviously incredibly professional, but it was quite obvious that there was some difficulties at Linux Format.
So now announce it on a podcast.
So now I'd like you to dish us some of the delicious, delicious Future Publishing flavored dirt. Like, what was the deal?
Well, the thing is that I've still got lots of friends at Future.
Right.
Especially in the editorial teams. The editorial teams at Future Publishing are great. It was incredibly difficult the last few months. I mean, we did a podcast. Ooh. If you listen to our tone, our personalities during those last months, and of course we all quit at the end of one of the podcasts, and I'm almost crying at the end of that. It was an incredibly difficult decision, right, to leave, but fundamentally I don't want to be necessarily unprofessional. I also want to focus on the positives, you know.
Yeah,
nothing to do with Linux Voice, but I don't want to dwell on, I'm just talking about me personally, it's a completely fair question. But I don't want to dwell on what Future Publishing's doing and how things were when we left and how things may well be for the people who I know still work there.
Yeah, yeah.
I was essentially, and I think the other guys were too, depressed. And it came to a point where we either gave up doing a job that we really enjoyed and went back to doing something more ordinary. Or we gave this a shot. And also, I always have to make this caveat. I wasn't involved in those early stages of the foundation of Linux Voice because of an no-compete clause in my contract.
Yeah. You are a master criminal.
Go ahead.
I was just going to ask one more question just on this particular point as well. I mean, when people leave long-established roles in organizations to do something like a startup or to do something brave and new like this, it's nerve-wracking. I mean, it's a big change. Do you guys have like families that were involved? Because I mean, it's easy for a bunch of single people to do this, but I mean, if you've got families, it's going to be difficult. Like, how was that transition as well?
Yeah, I feel it's odd actually talking about ourselves and myself in this way. I feel a little bit uncomfortable doing it, but yeah, I've got two kids. It was a huge decision. And it was a huge decision for Ben and for Mike and Andrew as well. I mean,
yeah,
we're still some, I don't know. I mean, we didn't earn a reasonable salary at Future. I mean, I'm not complaining about that either, but I don't know whether we'll ever earn the same that we used to at Future. So that was a big part of it.
Yeah.
And it was as simple as a trade-off as, you know, the zen of motorcycle maintenance, you know, finding some happiness in doing something else. But it was difficult. Yeah. But my family, luckily, were behind it and they're still behind it, you know, still making up the shortfall in my mortgage payments.
Right. Well, having a happier Graham around is probably going to be a big motivating factor there.
Well, no, absolutely.
At OzCon, I mean, it was July in 2013, and we met up again, and quite a few people said to me, I was a different person this year than I was last year.
Oh, yeah,
so
definitely.
I think that says it all.
I noticed it, yeah.
I think that leads quite neatly into the other question that I had. If you look at the way Linux Voice is set up, you're basically a free software, free culture nerd's wet dream, right? Everything is open, everything is public, you've got an open contributor policy, everything becomes Creative Commons 9 months afterwards. Exactly, right? You give half your profits away to projects and so on and so forth. This is, from the point of view of the free software, free culture community, this is fantastic. On the other hand, it does feel slightly like your team. You're throwing yourself on the grenade for our benefit. Not that we don't appreciate it, don't get me wrong, but is your goal literally to just make the thing as minimally sustainable as possible and then have fun? Or is the intention that you'd also quite like to be rich and massively successful as well?
That's a really good question. I don't think any of us consider ourselves throwing us on the grenade. I mean, I think creating Linux Voice, I think part of the success of the Indiegogo campaign was that people trusted us to deliver on our promise, which was actually to deliver, I think, a better product. You know, Future would say brand.
Yes.
and all of us want to do things in the right way, but we're also quite ambitious. And we don't want to make this, we want to make this more than sustainable for everybody's benefit. You know, it would be fantastic if other magazines did a similar thing, or if we could help other people, or do other things in a similar way. So at the moment, this first 12 months, I think, is just we're spending all our time concentrating on the magazine. But if we ever get any breathing space or trust contributors enough to be able to offload some more of the writing, then I'd love to look into some more kind of creative ways of working with Free Software and other people.
I know that we talked about this a little bit when we met up for lunch in Portland, and the thing that really struck me about this is to me is, like, over the years we've seen many success stories in terms of people making free software and free books and free albums and whatever else, what other content. Haven't really seen it very often in the context of magazines, and when people have tried to do it, they've typically worked together and made a free PDF that you can download, and then ultimately it's died on its ass because it's just so much work. But it seems like Linux Voice is really kind of championing this new way of doing things. Do you feel like at some point in the future you'd like to formalize guiding how other people can do it? Because it seems like this could arguably be the beginning of an online news agents of different types of content done this way.
Yeah, I think it's difficult because the old print model is dead in many ways. It's not going to work. It's not going to be the magic pill that's going to solve all of the publishing industry's problems.
Right,
but the fact that it's just five of us, the fact that we could probably make enough money to make it sustainable, the fact that other people could do the same thing if they were given some more support, I think there's a much more makery feel to that, and the maker revolution has happened and changed other industries, and I don't see why that won't have the same effect on printing, and all the better for the consumers, the people who buy the magazines, who at the moment, you know, that it's all based on advertising for many publishing companies, and advertising is not part of our business plan whatsoever.
Yeah, we really need like a 3D printer that can put ink on paper. I think that'd be kind of cool.
Actual printers do that, right? My printer does that.
just on a final thing as well, from my side, and then I want to make sure the other guys can get their questions in too. What have you had any response to Linux Voice from Future as well? It's not just Future though, but also the other like major publishers in the traditional kind of model. Have you had any feedback from them about what you guys are doing?
Well, yeah, I haven't heard anything back from Future.
Right.
Other than speaking informally to the people that we still know there,
like friends. Yeah. Yeah.
We've had actually some very interesting conversations with MediaLynx in Germany. They published Linux Pro and Linux Magazine in Europe. And I think, I can talk and talk about publishing, so I've got to be careful, but I don't want to bore everyone. But you know, in the US, a big distributor went bust. For big publishing companies, it's not so much of a problem. But in a way, we're not necessarily trying to compete with anyone, and I think what we do is quite unique. And there's no reason why we can't work with other, even Linux publishing companies to deal with problems such as distributors going bust or try to get better deals at news agents, which charge an absolute fortune just to stock our titles on their shelves.
Yeah, I was surprised when you told me that you can actually go and get Linux Voice in news agents. I thought it was just an online thing. I mean, how did that work?
No,
it's
real shops and stuff.
Yeah, you can in the UK. In fact, this is our first month into B8 Smith Travel, just for everyone going on holiday. But we've had to pay for that, and this is where this is. I mean, I listened to the last podcast where Stu said that we'd kind of just slotted into this and we could just kind of keep rolling. It was really difficult, and the bit that we had no idea about was the distribution and dealing with news agents and dealing with the people who do this. So what we're now trying to invent in our own heads is a kind of a way of doing business. Should we pay this money to W.H. Smith Travel if it means we're going to get greater exposure and therefore greater long-term sales, which in general we are as and when we've got the money to spend on it. But this is something we have absolutely no experience about.
Interesting. A separate question about magazines generally. You said that your deadline is this Friday, yes? And that's for which magazine?
It's the October issue.
Right. When does the October issue come out?
Subscribers will get it in about 2.5 weeks. It takes about a week to be printed. It takes another 6 or 7 days to be distributed to the various distribution centers. And then subscribers get it, and then it's probably on sale a week after that.
Right. So, a general question then. Why isn't that in October?
Well, I guess I used to think that this was some kind of cynical marketing ploy. But now that I know how it works, in Australia, where we're sold in the newsagents, some of the newsagents don't get our copies for almost 2 months. In the US, Barnes & Noble, for example, I think only issue 4 has only just gone on sale. Issue 6 is on sale in the UK and has been on sale for a week. And so, in fact, the month moniker, as redundant as it is there to try and capture all of the kind of global markets whenever the magazine goes out.
So October is just kind of an average of when it comes out. Why not just call it like issue 11 and not care about a month? I didn't realise that. I mean, I always found it immensely annoying that you could buy the October issue or thing at the end of August.
Is that because the old print media have got like an ancient pirate ship or something that they used to distribute these things around the world?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, we haven't changed it, you know, it's how we've done it. But I don't know. It's really
you need to think differently, Graham.
You're already overturning the magazine industry in every other way. You could fix this as well while you're at it, if you would. That would be brilliant.
We'd like them to be delivered by jetpack, by the way.
Drones.
Either that or drone,
drones. Excellent. Thank you very much for your time, Graham. We appreciate it.
Yeah.
I really appreciate you having me on. Thank you very much.
Where should people go to find out more about Linux Voice Magazine and your substandard podcast?
it's all on linuxvoice.com.
Wonderful.
That sounds like an
Well, thank you. You know what, Graham? I don't think anyone, certainly no one on this team in any way, it doesn't have anything but pure admiration for what you guys are doing. I know our listeners will as well. So, but again, listeners, remember, right? For Linux Voice to be for continued success, you need to go out and buy this thing. So go out and check it out. It's a great magazine in print and online. So thanks, Graham.
Thanks, John. Thanks, guys.
We are kicking off a brand new competition.
Yes, we are.
Mashed Voltage. Mashed. The voltage will be mashed and it will be grandiose. So this is basically how it's going to work, right? So in the spirit of Creative Commons and free culture, as we've talked about in this show, this podcast is available under a free culture Creative Commons license. And what we're inviting you all to do is to go out there and take all of the things that we've said in the past and mash them up using your favorite audio editing tool into something that is interesting and funny, right? So as a couple of examples, you may want to mock together a conversation between two presenters about something absolutely ludicrous, or you may want to take every time Axe says the word bollocks and string them all together.
Now be one entry.
You may want to,
maybe not that one, but yeah.
Right. You may want to reconstruct the intro from Star Wars using words that people on the show have said, whatever it might be, right? Any other ideas? Ludicrous stuff?
I think you've pretty much covered the gamut there, to be honest with you. I like the Star Wars one. Prove to us that the whole idea of this remix culture thing is not rubbish and people can do good and interesting things. And there are prizes.
Oh, yes.
What are the prizes, Jono?
Well, we're actually quite cheap. So the prize, what we're going to do is the winner, and we'll get into the dates and everything fairly soon, but the winner, the person with what I think we will probably consider to be the most impressive and or funniest, or preferably both.
I was going to say interesting and funny are the two major points, at least for
that's
me.
What we're looking for. Okay. The winner, each of the four presenters on the show, we will send you something from our house. Right? So we will pick something for you that we think you will like, and we will each individually mail it to you. So you'll get four different packages from each of us with something that we think you will like. Jeremy's looking around his office right now looking at shit to send.
I actually am.
So you'll get a little personal keepsake, that hopefully you won't use as a serial killer trophy. that we will send to you. Now, in terms of the submission date, we're gonna wrap this up for submissions on the 10th of September,
yep.
Right? So you've got basically about a month to get these in. There's loads of free editing software out there. Like there's things like Audacity that you can use. Which is, and basically you can just download the shows and then you can chop up the bits and pieces that you want. But be as creative as you want, you know? But here's the thing. When you have something, when you've got something together, you've got to post it to the forum. Go to community.badvoltage.org and post your submission to the forum when you've got something.
Yeah, so if you've made like an MP3 or something, you'll want to upload it somewhere. So you can upload it to SoundCloud or to your own website or put it in Dropbox or whatever you want to do.
Yeah, and make sure that the your submission that's posted to the forum is something that we can download. It should really be in either MP3 or OGG format, right? No weird .au files, please. And then the other thing as well is you can submit as many submissions as you want. So if you want to submit 10, that's fine. Go ahead. But get them onto the forum. There'll be a forum post that outlines all of this in more detail that will be linked in the show notes. And yeah, we look forward to seeing your submissions in this mashed voltage. Recently, I went to the O'Reilly Open Source Convention, also known as OSCON, and I was fortunate enough to be invited to the annual Google dinner for important open source people and me. Not only did I have a great evening with some interesting people, but Google also rather generously gave each guest a Samsung Gear Live smartwatch, so I figured let's give it the Bad Voltage treatment. To set the scene, I've had very little actual experience with smartwatches. I played with the Pebble watch a bit, which I felt was a little bit rubbish, but the Samsung one excited me much more. It doesn't have the shitty display like the Pebble does, and it seems to have much more guts under the miniature bonnet. In terms of features, the Samsung's got a 1.63-inch AMOLED display, Bluetooth for connecting to your phone, a mic for using the OK Google feature, heart rate monitor, and a built-in pedometer. The strap looks much cooler than I expected, and my wife even told me that she thinks the watch looks sexy on me. She must have been drunk. The phone also comes with a charger with a little square bracket that clips onto the phone to charge it. The overall package is very nice. Now, it will come as little surprise to wearables fans that this thing only works with a phone. It's really a second screen for your phone. It connected seamlessly to my Android Nexus 4 phone, and I was pleased to see that Samsung didn't take the route of locking me only in with Samsung devices in this case. Connecting to the phone was as simple as switching Bluetooth on and verifying a code. In use, I found the watch surprisingly useful. I previously poo-pooed the notion of a second screen in previous episodes, but I found it pretty handy. I can say OK Google and ask for a range of things, such as looking things up on Google itself, but also instructing my wrist butler to send an email or text message, navigate to a destination, take my heart rate, show my schedule for the day, and other things. Now, some of these are more pleasant to experience than others. For example, saying send a text message to Stuart Langridge, and it then ask me for my message and then sending it, that was an incredible experience. But asking who the lead singer in Iron Maiden is just showed me a boring Google search result. In those cases, I can tap the result and it loads it on my phone, but that's much less compelling. It feels there need to be more of the text message type experiences. I found seeing Google results as the fallback as an ultimately unsatisfying experience. Now, you'll all want to know about battery life. Android has a terrible reputation for battery life, and I was warned by others how shitty the battery life on smartwatches is, as both the watch and the phone are draining battery at the same time. I have to say, though, it was much better than I expected. I found both the watch and the phone going a full day with reasonable use, which is about the best you can expect from Android. Sadly, though, I wasn't confident enough in the battery life to trust travelling with it, and this is a shame as travelling is ultimately when the watch is going to be most useful. So overall, I found the Samsung Gear Live a much more compelling watch than I expected. The integration with my phone was flawless, despite some boring fallback experiences with Google Search. If they buff up some of those experiences and make the battery better, they'll be onto a truly compelling device. So, what is the Bad Voltage verdict? The Samsung Gear Live is a pretty damn good stab at a smartwatch. We're at the beginning of this wearable revolution, and Samsung has delivered a pretty compelling option. Well worth a look.
Honestly? Really?
What?
A question. I mean, you're obviously more impressed with the thing than you thought you were going to be.
Which
is setting the bar pretty low.
I had incredibly low expectations.
Yes. No, agreed. Do you think that it's a compelling device for this stage of the smartwatch revolution, i.e. right at the beginning?
Yes.
Or do you think it's actually a good example of the genre?
You can look at it from two lenses, I think. The first is the engineering of it, which I think is really kind of what you should look at in many ways at the beginning of this kind of genre. And then there's the actual, is it a useful and interesting thing to use? From an engineering perspective, it's really impressive what they've done. I mean, the fact that they've crammed a computer, a pretty nice little screen, and a reasonable battery, and networking functionality into that small of a form factor, I think is pretty impressive. And the thing isn't as big and bulky as I was expecting. It feels pretty nice on the wrist. It's not too heavy. And like I said earlier on, you know, Erica seems to think it looks pretty cool, which surprised me.
Surprises me too. I've seen your watch, which your wife bought for you, and it's really nice. Right? The Samsung. Right.
I was going to say, from a design perspective, the first three Android Wear devices, one from LG, this one, and then the one from Motorola, from a design perspective, I think all look A, really different, but B, really nice.
Yeah, I mean, it could have looked like one of those crappy Casio calculator watches from when we were kids.
But, and I think the Samsung actually looks like the worst out of the three.
Right. And I'd agree. Like, the Samsung one has a square display. It doesn't have the round display I know some of the new watches are going to have, which I think will look a bit nicer as well. But from the usage perspective, I feel like they nailed it about 60 to 70%. Like I say, I'll give you an example. We were meeting up with our neighbors last weekend, and I was doing some washing up downstairs. I was wearing the watch. I heard my phone beep. I felt the watch buzz on my wrist. I saw that my neighbor had texted me to ask me to bring over more beer, right? So I turned my wrist around, it switched the phone, that switched the watch on, so like it kind of enabled the display, because normally the display just shows kind of the watch face, but when you twist your wrist around, it then enables it so you can interact with it. And then I said, send a text message to Adam Lorimer. I read out my thing, because my hands were all wet, and it sent the message instantly. I managed to interact with him without even touching it. And that, to me, was pretty groundbreaking. That was really cool. And that's a genuinely useful use for the watch. But it's all those kind of crappy fallback experiences to Google search that makes it ultimately less satisfying than you'd expect. Like, I would like to be able to say, who is the singer in Iron Maiden as a pithy example, and it will tell me. Also, the watch doesn't talk to me, and I'd like it to be able to talk to me as well in some cases, or to at least be able to enable that. Maybe it does, but I haven't been able to find that in the settings.
I think this is really the very early days of Android Wear in general, though. Right now, it's basically Google Now on your wrist. And I think as more app developers get involved and as the ecosystem evolves, I think Android Wear, maybe when it hits version 3, will really hit its stride. I think it's going to be some compelling technology. I know I'm less anti-wearable than you two, but...
Well, the thing is, as well, as one thing I got a chance to look at, but I didn't get a chance to really delve into, was the navigation. Like, I can imagine, for example, like, I use my GPS on my phone all the time when I'm traveling, and I'm always petrified that I'm going to get busted by the cops for looking at my phone, because cops in different parts of the US are really anal about this. Like, in LA, cops seem to be a lot worse than around here, for example. Mm. And having it on your wrist, you don't have that problem as much. Like, that would be a really useful use for the navigation, for example. But I agree with you, Jeremy. I think we're at the beginning of all this, but so far I was pretty impressed with what they've managed to lash together, obviously given some of the limitations of Android itself as well.
That's one of the things I think is interesting. I find myself nudging closer day by day to a smartwatch. None of them yet seem right, but I think smartwatches are getting better and better as I nudge close to them. So when I finally tip over the edge and buy one, they'll be quite good. But the impression I do have at the moment is that it is still very early days. The Samsung Gear Live that you've got is a good example of essentially a pretty early prototype.
Yeah.
It's still definitely an early adapter device, I think.
Yeah.
And they really do need to fix the battery. I mean, the battery life for a watch cannot be one day.
This is one of the things that depresses me about phones, but even more so about watches, is Jono saying, well, you know, I got a day's worth out of it, so that's not too bad. The amount of expectation shortfall, I mean, seriously, the watch on my wrist, I replaced the battery, and it was an ordinary watch battery. It lasted 10 years. Admittedly, it can't search Google, but, you know, a day's life. That's like saying, well, I ate this paella and there wasn't too much shit in it. It's just no.
Say 4 or 5 days has got to be a bare minimum. A week would really be more.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I agree with you. And that's going to be the major constraint. In fact, as we've always known, is battery life, right? I mean, I know Android is becoming more efficient in the way they're building it. The fact that it's, I think the other aspect that's a bit of a pain is the fact that it talks to your phone. I'm sure that'll change in the future. I'm sure that in the future you'll just have everything on your wrist, but it's a bit annoying because, you know,
you think the Dick Tracy watch is the future? I agree with that.
I think at some point in the future, you will have everything on. You'll have everything in your watch.
I don't think I mean, screens are getting bigger on phones. So you think it's going to go from people carrying around those ridiculous phablets to just wanting a 1.6 inch
screen? To having one strapped to your wrist.
No, I think I'm convinced that at some point in the future, what you'll have is you'll have like a, you know, T-Mobile account or something like that. You'll have multiple devices. Like right now, you have to have a SIM card plugged into each device that you have. I think in the future, you'll have multiple devices, all part of your mobile subscription, all talking to the same network through your account. There'll be a more efficient way of doing it. And I'm sure that your watch will work like that. Because right now, for example, you know, as an example, I went upstairs to my office and I left my phone downstairs and my watch suddenly stopped being useful. Right.
So you're not saying it will replace your phone. You're saying it will not be dependent on your phone.
Right. I mean,
yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah,
at the moment, yes,
exactly. It won't replace it.
Some of the stuff is, it's a slave to your watch, a slave to your phone, a second screen, because then it can offload all the complexity of connecting to the network and radios and all this kind of thing off to your phone. And I agree with you, you could potentially break that link. But a lot of the other reason is that it's got a 1.63 inch screen, right? You can't read your email sensibly on a watch, unless you're going to have the watch which goes all the way up your forearm like Dusty Springfield, it's just not going to happen. So,
no, like I say, I'm not saying for a second that watches will replace phones. I don't think they will. What I'm saying is that I think the watches of the future will independently connect to the network. So, you know, right now to talk for my watch to know about my email and to talk to Google and to do all of that and to navigate, it needs to connect to the internet via my phone. Like, it authenticates with my phone. I'm just saying that in the future, I don't think you'll have that dependency on the phone.
One of the things that does, I must confess, surprise me, is that the battery life is so low. I mean, yes, it's that low on a phone, right? I grant you that. And a phone has a screen, and the screen eats an awful lot of your battery life. But the phone's also got a complicated radio, and it needs to drop on and off the network. It goes on and off Wi-Fi, so on and so forth. Your watch needs a low-power Bluetooth connection and a little screen, and that's it. Admittedly, it's smaller, so there's less room in it for battery. But
I was
going to
say, for how much they're packing into that little watch, the battery has to be phenomenally small and light.
Well, I grant you that to some extent. But one of the things that I've noticed about phones, if you put a phone in airplane mode, it will last 3 or 4 days. Not a problem. So most
I mean, I have a Nexus 5, and even using it all day pretty aggressively, I make it through a whole day. And airplane mode, I think that thing would last for 4 days.
To be fair as well, with the watch, for example, my second charge of the watch, I didn't really use it very much. I went back to use my normal watch, and it sat on my bathroom counter, basically just showing you the time mode, so not using it, and it lasted days. Like, it lasted probably 2 or 3 days. It's when you're actually using it a lot, like when it's connected to your phone and it's sucking out data from your phone and displaying it on your wrist, that's when the battery starts.
So final question then, would you have actually bought this with your own money?
Yeah, I mean, that is the major question. I think, to be honest with you, no. Because right now, I think it's really cool what they've achieved, but there are enough kind of like rough edges in the fact that the, like, seeing Google, so I can't express enough, like, seeing Google search results when you ask for something on OK Google, it's just, it completely, like, roughens up the experience. And, I mean, it's functional, but I don't want to see a Google search result on my wrist, tap it, and then it opens up on my phone. I might as well just use my bloody phone in the first place if I want to do that. So I think when they knock off some of these rough edges and the battery life gets better, I will go out and buy. I will have a smartwatch in my future. I know that, but this isn't quite there yet. I think it's 60% of the way there, but it's they've made a really, really good solid stab at it, but it's not quite there yet enough for me to want to go out and spend my own cash on it.
So I think you guys would all agree that it's irrefutable that open source projects have done software very well. But I think, and we discussed this a little bit previous to the show, I think one of the areas where open source software projects have kind of stumbled in the recent past, or even not so recent past, is when they try to make that transition to hardware. Because obviously hardware is a more established, very proprietary business, even more so than software, right? Especially when you get into things like phones and their basebands and tablets and a lot of the chips and, you know, the SoCs and all that kind of stuff. Those are very closed markets where people are very, very, very unwilling to share any kind of specs whatsoever. So recently, you know, KDE did the Vivaldi tablet, and not so recently, you know, there was the OpenMoco and the Neo Freerunner and those kinds of things, which were both free software organizations trying to make that transition into hardware. A lot of the impetus behind that was they wanted it to, the whole stack from hardware to software, to be free. And I'm struggling to think of a success story kind of in of that nature. So I'm wondering what you guys think about that kind of transition and how the future maybe could look a little bit different, and maybe look back and see why they haven't been as successful as you may have hoped they would have been.
I don't think there is a success story. I can't think of one anyway. And I think there's lots of reasons why they haven't been successful. I think part of it is just an oversimplification of how hardware works. You know, a good friend of mine who works for a very, very large consumer electronics company, who is in the software business as well as in the hardware business, he has commented on a bunch of times, and he said, it's amazing how different software and hardware people are from a mindset and a philosophy perspective. And I think that, it's with software, like, people are really empowered to kind of create new things, right? You have a cool idea for a feature, you can go and build it. Whereas with hardware, it's like, it's a whole different world. I think, like, they think, oh, well, we can do software, we can do hardware. It's easy. It's just like, it's like building PCs in the 90s, right? You just plug these bits together and install an operating system on it. No, not so much.
Well, I think software's obviously easier to do from scratch, right? To do hardware, you have to build a manufacturing plan and get a whole supply chain set up. And there's just the logistics of hardware are orders of magnitude different than the logistics of software.
I think that's exactly it. I mean, when you talk about a project like this, there were other things like this as well. There were people putting together an open source free software graphics card, which was built on an FPGA. That was 2 or 3 years ago. You've got Bunny, the chap who hacked the original Xbox, is building a laptop called a Novena. Which is it's all open hardware, and he's doing a really good job with that. But he's gone into this. He's the guy who built the Chumbies, right? So he's well aware of how the world of hardware works. I think one of the things that surprises me, but it doesn't really surprise me, is that an awful lot of software projects, like you say, KDE with the Vivaldi, the Neo Freerunner OpenMoco project, sitting around saying, well, we can't get our software to work on this hardware because you know, the manufacturers won't give us the specs, or it's just too difficult, or we're sick of being 6 months behind the times. A new thing comes out and then we have to reverse engineer it. We'll just get some hardware built, right? And that's easy. Right. All you have to do is just fly to Shenzhen and then tell a guy, and then you've got 50,000 of them, right? No, it doesn't work like that. Which is why if you look at people saying, well, why isn't Ubuntu shipping on laptops in Newegg or PC World or whatever? And then, you know, because it takes time to go out there and build up all these relationships with OEMs and ODMs and so on and so forth in Taiwan or in Shanghai and so on. It's a really difficult world to get into, the interaction with hardware. And I can see why a lot of people think, well, why don't we just get our own built then? But every time anyone's tried it, it's been a failure. I'm discussing this a little while ago. The obvious counter example here is the Raspberry Pi. But the Raspberry Pi wasn't built out of a sense of frustration that they wanted some hardware and the thing already existed. They created a new type of product.
Well, and it's interesting. What you just said, I think, touches on maybe what the real issue is here, which is it isn't so much about being able to build hardware. Maybe the real issue here, thinking about it, is being able to engage with companies.
Yeah.
Because if, like, thinking about open source projects in a very general set, like pure upstream projects, I'm not talking about like Ubuntu with it, like Ubuntu's got a commercial stakeholder with Canonical or, you know, Fedora with Red Hat and things like that, is pure upstream companies don't generally have partner relationships, thinking about it.
No,
pure upstream projects. They don't generally have these partner relationships.
Which is one of the reasons partner relationships as a concept are massively undervalued, in my opinion.
Right, exactly.
The difficulty of creating them, sustaining them, the value of doing so, tends to get seriously underweighted, because to build a software project, you don't need them.
But I mean, there are some exceptions, obviously. I mean, a good example of this is Ardour, the multi-track software that Paul Davies works on. And he has an arrangement with, who is it, Mixbus or someone. Like there's been various hardware products that have shipped with Ardour, and there's various software products that have Ardour as a base. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that's because of the open source project. I think that's because of Paul. Like, he's just a really smart guy, and he runs that project. So he, for all intents and purposes, is partner relations. And he comes from that world as well. So I wonder whether that's really the issue here is, you know, invariably a lot of upstream projects, open source upstream projects, are coming from it from a perspective of open source and freedom. And again, like, that kind of angle, but not necessarily delivering value to customers.
Well, and I think part of that too, or maybe even an extension of that, is if you look at like KDE, they took a very principled approach, right? They wanted the firmware to be open source, and they wanted a lot of things that the typical hardware manufacturing process does not currently account for. Where if you look at when Canonical wanted to build a phone, they were accepting of the fact that the baseband was not going to be open source, even though they are an open source company, because they took kind of a more pragmatic approach, where I think a lot of the open source software companies trying to build hardware take that more dogmatic approach, and then the hardware companies just say, you know what, you would have been our smallest order anyway, and you're asking for things that people that order 100 times as many count as you don't want, just never mind, we don't want to deal with it.
Yeah,
and I think that becomes the reality.
But do you think that's the thing? It's purely a question of volumes, that you can't get in the door to have the discussions with people.
Yeah, I think if you're going to be the biggest order like Apple, you can dictate terms almost all you want. If you're going to be the smallest order, you can dictate no terms at all.
Borrow a dollar and the bank owns you, borrow $1 million and you own the bank, kind of thing. Although it's probably $100 billion these days.
What's an interesting example here as well is that the notion of quote-unquote amateurs or like people who aren't big companies building and delivering successful hardware products. We're seeing that happening all the time with the whole Maker Revolution and Kickstarter and Indiegogo, right? We're seeing people forming little companies or little organizations to ship really interesting devices. The world's littered with them. Mm-hmm. So to me, it's not even about so much the process of delivering a hardware product, of working with a manufacturing company to deliver it. We're seeing that all the time. It really is something to do with open source projects, which would suggest that it's the dogmatic piece. Because, you know, if like what Pebble came out of Kickstarter, didn't it? And
But I think that's a good example. Look at how over budget and behind schedule Pebble was. I think a lot of people don't have appreciation for the number of iterations you have to go through with different PCB designs and learning. Like the smallest of manufacturing defects will cause months delays and huge overruns in cost. And I think that's something that is just, if it's your first time doing it, might take you off guard and can very much cause your project to fail, I think.
Oh, if you look at Kickstarter projects, an awful, awful, awful lot of the electronics projects start off very good and they get the funding and everything. And then a year goes past and you get the occasional update saying, yeah, we're still working out on the manufacturing pipeline from Shenzhen or whatever.
Right. You know, I mean, I bought one of the simplest things you can imagine on Kickstarter, which was that Pressy, which was a little button that goes in any Android phone set.
Yeah.
And that thing was like 6 months overdue. Actually, maybe even more. I ordered the thing like a year ago. I think it came last month.
Hang on, what is this thing?
It's called the Pressy.
What is this?
And it's just a little button that goes into your headphone port, and you can set up a whole bunch of different things. So if you click it twice, it'll take a picture. If you do one long press and one short press.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
So it's just a configurable extra hardware button. But that thing seems pretty simple, and they were like triple their original estimated time on when it was going to be delivered.
I mean, admit, and that doesn't even have a PCB. I'm sure they would say, the Pressy people would say, actually, you'd be surprised how complicated the hardware is internally and how much work we had to do to make it happen and all this kind of thing. And I agree with them, it is. But equally, the space shuttle, it is not. It's a button. and like you say, yeah. Even that, because I think people are building software projects are used to the idea that you can make a change and essentially that change has then been made. If you're a large-scale sysadmin, you are conscious of the distinction between someone checks a thing into GitHub and it is deployed on our 38 servers. But even that time gap, there's a big difference between we have come up with a plan for this piece of hardware and we have 50,000 of them. That's a two-year gap.
And the thing is, I guess, as well, is it's not just the production, it's then the distribution, right? Because I was just thinking about this, that I was just thinking maybe the solution to a lot of this is going to be almost like Lego brick type components for building hardware solutions.
There was the phone blocks did that for phones.
Right, exactly.
And as we're starting to see things like the Raspberry Pi, like Arduino and the Arduino shields and so on, you're now in a position where you can sit down and build yourself essentially a piece of hardware by just basically getting a Raspberry Pi, plugging it into a couple of things that you want to, and then putting that in a box. It's not mass produced hardware. It's not a thing where you build this thing and then make 50,000 of them.
And it's also not polished. From a consumer perspective. Yeah.
It's kind of the Etsy approach to hardware, you know?
Right.
The approach that Etsy takes to creative goods. You can do that kind of thing with hardware, and that's the maker revolution. It's where you want it's where you want to change from being individual handmade Etsy stuff to having 50,000 t-shirts ready to sell to someone. At that point, you tip over from, I will hand make the boxes and put an Arduino in each one, to I'll set up a shipping pipeline from China. That's where it becomes hard. And Kickstarter projects are all organized around the 50,000, not around the one.
And I guess the complexity here as well is that there is a contradiction that's happening here. Because on one hand, the 3D printing maker revolution is we're seeing all of these reusable components. Like just as a very, very quick story, Chris Anderson wrote this book about the maker revolution, and he used his granddad as an example. I think I might have mentioned this in a previous show. He used his granddad as an example, who moved from Switzerland to the US. He basically created the automated sprinkler system. And he spent all of his money on patent fees and all the rest of it to make this thing work. And Chris thought, you know, Chris Anderson is very involved in Arduino and DIY drones and all that kind of stuff. And he thought, I wonder if I could make this to myself with the current like 3D printing Arduino revolution that's happening right now. And he could do it way quicker, way cheaper, because there was a ton of pre-existing Lego brick components out there that have been built by people who are growing weed to make growing weed more efficient, right? So he was able to do that. The challenge, I think, is that while all that stuff is happening, you've also got the contradiction here is that consumer products are getting much slicker and sexier. And to Jeremy's point, like the consumer facing experience is much, much nicer. So on one hand, like you can't open things up because the screws have been removed and all the rest of it, like Apple products, and people want that. But then you've got, like, we're finally, the hardware world is becoming more accessible through all of these Lego pieces, but then they're ugly and they're clunky. Right. Like,
I think the market's kind of bifurcated into DIY. You can almost do anything, but it's not going to be polished, and things that you almost can't open, like you said, at all. There's no screws or anything. It's sealed and basically a black box, but it's very polished.
It's the mentality.
Yeah, because all of those examples we have had earlier on, like the Vivaldi tablet and the OpenMoco and the Neo and all that kind of stuff. Every single one of those products is something I would not buy.
But they are But what's interesting is they were attempts to make a slick, commercial looking, mass market looking product. If what you could get was a tablet which was in a 3D printed case and you had to buy the bits and plug them together yourself, They probably would have been successful in building that hardware. It just would have been targeted at a much narrower group of people.
So, yeah. So
this is very much another topic I think that I'd be interested to hear what the community has to say.
Yeah.
You know, do you think are we missing a hardware product that was built by an open source community, software community that has been successful? Because it's possible we all three of us just missed it. And what's your opinions on this topic in general? Head to community.badvoltage.org and let us know.
End of the show. Time for the emails. Oh, no. Hang on. Wait, that's not right.
Wrong podcast. speaking of incompetent podcasts, we need to have a conversation about something.
We do.
Lunduk didn't show. And we have a policy with people like him, which currently is to not fire him and to instead punish him with an avatar.
Yes.
Right? So, ideas for what we could have?
Well, I reckon we should actually, a lot of the ones that we've done before, but you know, we've gone and looked them up or whatever. We should actually craft one, I think, specifically designed to annoy Brian.
That's a good idea. what annoys him?
Well, how best to annoy
Unity?
The fact that he's wrong all the time.
Yeah, well, he doesn't like Unity. I don't know, employment.
Well, exactly, you know, consistency, showing up seems to annoy him.
maybe a picture of a clock.
Well, the problem is that we need to pick things that annoy him more than they annoy us.
I know something that I have an idea for something.
Speak.
Something to do with the Linux Action Show. What about a picture of Chris? What about sending it to Chris?
It's no,
a bit cold though, isn't it?
That's way too mean.
Yeah, you can't have him be another actual person.
We made Nero the queen, but I don't think anyone's under any illusions that Her Majesty Elizabeth is posting on community.badvoltage.org.
In your defense as well, like, you were Charlton Heston in like a little thong type thing as well. So
yeah, precisely, right? Again, not an actual person we're likely to run into. Is Charlton Heston even still alive?
I thought that was just an actual picture of you a couple of years ago.
At Blackpool.
Last time I was that thin was about 2 months after I was born.
And then your mum shoved a pie in your face. Okay. What about the Jupiter broadcasting logo?
The Jupiter broadcasting logo. Yes, that's what we need.
Let's stick it in the heart because because he loves it.
Do it, man. Bust out your. Bust out your GIMP skills, but presumably now you've got a Mac. Bust out your Photoshop skills.
Shut the hell up! I mean, I do not have Photoshop. I actually do have. GIMP on my Mac. By the way. I don't want anyone to think that I use this Mac out of choice, right? I have to use this Mac as part of my job, right?
an argument that didn't work for the Nazis at Nuremberg, and it's not going to work for you.
What is that? Which law is that? Yeah, Godwin's law.
Godwin's law, right there. No, I agree. Bust out your GIMP skills.
I will bust them out. I don't like the fact that you just said bust out your GIMP skills on a show where we've just invited people to mash up things that we're saying.
that may have not been the brightest of ideas in retrospect.
Yep.
You set them up and the community will knock them down.
Yeah, pretty much. Well, I think good show. Thank you again to Graham for joining us for an interview. Also, I just want to say a quick thank you to A2 Hosting and Bytemark once again for helping to provide our infrastructure for shipping the show as well as the forum as well. So,
yeah, no, thank absolutely. You. And thank you to Google for donating the Samsung Gear Live full review. If you're another multi-billion-dollar multinational company and you want to send us stuff that you want reviewed, just say the word and we'll complain about its battery life.
All right, without further ado, we'll see you on the next episode of A Bad Voltage. You like that? No, not so much?
No.
I think so.